Guys doing all right? Yeah. You look good today. In the 1930s, my grandfather, his family, it was Great Depression era. They moved to Toledo, Ohio, and they were searching for work, as so many families were during that time. They were dirt poor, as so many families were during that time. My grandfather got a job, 10, 12 years old, something like that, got a job as a newspaper boy, like delivering papers to people's houses. And he said along the way, there was one house in particular that really stood out. It was this absolute mansion. And in that era, in that time, to have that kind of wealth was just unheard of. Now, I don't know who the family was, but it was on the level of like a Rockefeller. I mean, these were extraordinarily wealthy people. And there's one moment that stood out in that time period that would influence my grandfather for his life, just changed the way he viewed wealth, changed the way he viewed things, give him a dream of what success might look like, in fact. And he was delivering papers one day. When he came to the door, there was a servant there at the door, the help, who said, "Mr. So-and-so would like to see you." And my grandfather, just a boy at the time, you know, in his dirty clothes, pack of newspapers on his back, was escorted in through these massive gates into this massive doors. And he described this hallway that was ornamented with just gorgeous things he had never seen before, wealth he had never seen before, luxury he had never seen before. And then he goes down this long corridor and finally gets to this sitting room, and they pull back these velvet curtains that like etched themselves in my grandfather's memory. And there's this man sitting in this luxurious chair, and he calls him over and just wanted to thank him for bringing the newspapers on time every day. I gave him a large tip and sent him out, and that was it. But something about that moment for this impoverished boy who had never seen anything like that just captured his imagination. When we come to the text today, we're in Ecclesiastes chapter 7. It feels a lot like that moment. Like so far in the text, we've heard the exploits of Solomon. Right? We've heard his stories as a young man pursuing pleasure, his parties, his work projects, his life, his laughter, his drinking, his foolishness, his art, his sexual exploits. I mean, we've heard it all. We've heard the stories. We've seen him express these horrific, gut-wrenching doubts about his faith and then turn to God and yet say, "Yeah, I'm going to trust you. You make all things beautiful. And it's time." We've seen him get angry. We've seen him frustrated. We've seen all these things. But this is something different. When we come to Ecclesiastes chapter 7, it feels like we just came to the gate and a servant says, "Hey, he wants to see you." And you're like, "Why would he want to see me? I don't even know, but he wants to see you." And he escorts you in through this huge gates. And you go down this long hall with these giant cedars that hold this giant room that at one time held the world's greatest parties. And as you walk down, you see these works of art, and you see these crowds of women passing, all of whom are his wives. And you see the musicians playing, and you round the corner into the throne room in his 20,000 square foot personal palace. And there in this giant throne is this ornately dressed man who is aged. And he's still dressed better than anyone you've ever seen, but now he's an old man. And unlike all the rampages we've seen, all the screaming we've seen, all the fussing we've seen, now he just wants to sit. And he says, "I've seen a lot in life. Like, I've done it all. And I've owned it all, and I've seen it all. And there's a few things that you only learn with experience, and he wants us to hear it today." Ecclesiastes chapter 7, starting in verse 1. The first thing he does is he leans into us, and with this big smile on his face, he says this: "A good shim is better than a shimon." A good shem in Hebrew is the word for name. But it's better. A good name, a good reputation, good character. It's better than shimon, fine perfume. It's not just that these two words sound alike and look alike. There's a lot more that he wants us to consider in this. He says that there are things back then, just as there are things now. There are things you can do to make yourself look good, to smell good. There are things that you can do to make yourself presentable in this world. Now, I want you to think, back then, this is not just pre-scientific. This is pre-deodorant. So in a room like today, just imagine the smell that would be coming up. Like, this is the day when people rarely bathed, and if they did, it was usually in a public pool that was stagnant water. Like, your smell, a person's body odor, it precedes you. You could smell a person before you ever saw them in that context. Your body odor, it fills a room. Like, when you come in, you're like, ah, there you are. You know, back then, as there are now, there were a number of things you could do to impress people. You could buy yourself a nice robe. You could pour oil on your skin, make your skin soft. You could import Egyptian eyeliner. Remember, he had a lot of Egyptian wives. There were a lot of things you could do back then to make yourself look good. And today, there's even more. If you think about it, today you can work out. You can buy nice clothes. You can have surgeries today. Today you can take, you know, fat off your stomach and put it in your lips. You can adjust your nose. You can make your ears smaller or bigger. You can do whatever you want today. And Solomon says, there's things you can do to make yourself attractive, and those are good. Back then, the best thing you could do, the creme de la creme, the top of the chain, was to buy fine perfume. Because it was rare and it was expensive. If you think, do you guys remember the story in John chapter 12? Mary, not the mother of Jesus, but the disciple, the one who followed him around. Mary anoints Jesus' feet the day right before he's going to go into Jerusalem and die. And do you remember Judas gets so upset? Do you remember why? Because that pint of perfume cost a year's wages. She just poured tens of thousands of dollars of perfume out on his feet. Can you imagine? That is how expensive fine perfume was. So if you had all the ultimate luxuries in life, You could do everything. You could spend any amount of money to make yourself look good, Solomon says. There are things you can do. You can work out. You can buy nice clothes. You can have soft skin. You can artfully mess up your hair. You can have surgery. There's a lot of things you can do. But if when you walk in a room, your name's preceding you, and it stinks, it doesn't matter how good you look or how good you smell. That a good name, your character, ages so much better than your looks. A good name, like a good perfume, will precede you. People will already know what you stand for and who you are. A good name, like a good perfume, will fill a room. When you come into the room, you should influence those around you. And Solomon says, at the end of the days, when you get his age, like, it doesn't matter how good you smell. But it does matter what people think of your name. When you die, nobody cares how good you smell. Watch this. A good name is better than fine perfume, and the day of death is better than the day of birth. Have you ever had one of those conversations with an older folk where you're like at a nursing home and they say something crazy, but you don't want to be disrespectful, so you're like, okay, Grandpa. Yeah. This doesn't this feel like one of those things where you're like, Solomon, he's lost it. Don't tell anyone. Okay, Solomon. You know, you really want to be nice to this old man, but here's the deal. I've been to funerals, and I've been there at the day of death. And I've also been, the one to hold a baby on the day of the birth. Not only my own children, but some of yours. And I can tell you, verifiably, that the day of birth, there's about a million ways that the day of birth is better than the day of death. And I've read my Bible. When you go through the Bible, biblically speaking, death is not good. It's not. Do you remember where death came from? When God created Adam and Eve, he said, the day that you eat of the tree, the day that sin enters the world, that's the day when death is going to come. And we're not just talking about physical death. Physical death is the separating, the tearing apart of the body and the soul. But we're talking about spiritual death here. The tearing apart of people who were created in the image of God to be with God forever. Tearing apart of that relationship with God. That when those two things happen, it's bad, verifiably. The Bible says that the wages of sin is death. That sin tears us apart from God. It tears us apart from our meaning, from the author of life, from the one from whom the source of all life. And when you tear yourself away from the source of all life, you die. And that's bad. So how could the day of death possibly be better than the day of birth? And Solomon here, I want you to read this. This is wisdom literature. So he's not making some sweeping statement. He's not saying in every situation. He wants us to think about this. This is an invitation for us to dialogue with him. We're supposed to ask. He's pushing us. The reason he said it this way is because he knows there are a million ways that the day of birth is better than the day of death. A million ways. And we can all think of those. But if we don't stop to think about the few ways that the day of death is actually better than the day of birth, we might just miss out on the whole point of life between those 2 days. So here's the deal. If life is about me, if I am the center of the universe, then there is nothing more important than my presence. The day of my death is the ultimate tragedy. If I'm the center of the universe, then my death ends everything. But Solomon wants us to point out that if the scriptures are true, if God is making everything beautiful, if life is about something so much bigger than me, then let me ask you this. What's better when God, the artist, picks up the brush and starts to paint? And starts the project that he calls your life. When he starts to knit you together and lay out the opportunities and all the things you can do. What's better, that day or the day when he finishes the last stroke? He sets down the brush and looks at your life and says, "That's good. I'm finished. That's beautiful." See, the day of death is all about completion. That if you trust God for your life, you trust God for the opportunities he puts before you, you trust God for the timing, you trust God for what the place he put you, and everything that he put before you in your life that we talked about last week. If you trust God for that, then the best day of your life is when it's done, when it's completed, when it's fulfilled, when you can start to see the beauty of what God has done. It's when my frustrations are over. It's when the pain and the process and the brokenness is done. It's when you can say, "I've finished the race. I've completed all that God had in store for me. I've experienced what God wanted me to experience." And at that moment, when you die, you can know that you've done everything that you needed to do. You know that God is done with you. I know you're thinking, "But Paul, you've got a young wife and you've got 2 kids and this church is just starting to grow and there's so many awesome things going on." And let me be the first to say, I don't want to die. Like I wanna grow old with Jenny. And I wanna watch my kids have kids, and I wanna see those kids who are sweating up in the nursery right now. I wanna see them grow up and become godly men and women. I wanna marry them off. I hope to dedicate their kids someday. I do. But here's the reality. Whether God gives me 5 more years or 50 more years says nothing about the beauty and value of my life. The most beautiful life this world has ever seen lasted 33 years. I've already outlived that. We talked about this last week. Quantity and quality are 2 different things. Pretending like you're never going to die is no way to live, Solomon says. Look at verse 2. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting, for death is the destiny of everyone, and the living should take this to heart. Before we unpack this, let me introduce a little theme to you. In philosophy and theology, there's these two categories that I think are helpful. There's two ways when you talk about something as good, you can mean that in several different ways. But one way is what we call the secondary good. And the other is what we call primary good. Sometimes it's called an instrumental good and an ultimate good, although ultimate's a bit over the top there. But so secondary and primary good. So a secondary good might not be good in and of itself. It might actually be bad. But the point of a secondary good is that it leads you. It's a means to get to a primary good, to something that's really good. So rather than talk about this in theory, let's say I go to the doctor and my doctor leans over and says, "Paul, you know, dieting is really good." Well, I could look at him and say, "You're insane. Dieting is awful. There's nothing good about voluntarily starving yourself. It's awful." So in and of itself, dieting is not good. But if I'm seeking a primary good, if I'm seeking to enjoy health, to enjoy my life, then I could say dieting is good because it allows me to enjoy life, to enjoy health. Now, if you think about it, life is full. There are tons and tons of these things. Let me just give you a few lists. Sports drills, practicing in sports, swimming laps in the pool, practicing the piano, going to the dentist, doing dishes, disciplining your kids, and probably my least favorite of all these is grammar. In and of itself, there is nothing good about grammar. I believe that it's a grievous evil. But if I ever hope to effectively communicate with people, daggone it, I have to study grammar. It's a necessary evil to get to the good that I want. So in the same way, though, if someone turned one of these secondary goods into an ultimate or primary good, it would be sick. It would be perverted. If someone just loved going to the dentist, you'd be like, what's wrong with you? If someone just loved spanking their kids, you'd be like, we need to report them to someone. If someone just loved grammar, I don't know what to do with you. Those things are not the good, but they get you to the good. Now, Solomon's going to say, if someone longed to have well-adjusted kids, they might hate disciplining their kids in and of itself. But at that moment, if they really long for their kids, the best for their kids, they better not hate discipline. And you know what? Some, if you really want oral health, you better not hate the dentist. You got to go anyways. It's a good. And if someone wants to win in a sport, you better not hate practice. And Solomon's going to add to this long list that if you want to live life well, you better not hate funerals. Now Solomon, he spent some time in the house of feasting. He knows. He spent huge portions of his life there. And this old man sitting here in his throne room leaning into you says, I've spent the years there. I've been in the house of feasting and it's good. And he loved it. And he has that huge room just built for that where you can fit 20,000 people at one time. And it is awesome. He says, it's good. But here's the deal. When you're sitting there in the middle of the party and the music's blaring and everyone looks good and the food tastes awesome and people are talking about nothing and everyone's laughing, no one ever stops to think, I wonder if I'm right with God right now. He says, but if you show up at a funeral, it might feel awful. But a funeral will force you to ask, what in the world am I doing with my life? You know, any day I might be the person in that box. And so the questions you start asking are totally different. Not what am I going to eat right now, or what am I going to enjoy, or how does this music make me feel? The question I'm going to ask are things like, did I kiss my wife today? And did I stop and actually listen to my daughter when she wanted to tell me a story? And did I wrestle with my son? And did I ignore that person who was hurting? And was I generous? And did I tell my neighbor about Christ? You know, when you go to the house of mourning, you ask a whole different set of questions. The house of mourning is not good, but I tell you what, if you want a good life, you cannot hate or avoid the house of mourning. The living should take this to heart, he says. Mourning not only brings a depth to your life, but hardships generally can actually be good for your heart. Watch this. This is my favorite part of this text. Frustration is better than laughter because a sad face, literally it says, because an ugly face is good for the heart. This is the idea that if you're frustrated, life is going to be frustrating. Amen. Anyone? Life is going to be frustrating. And Solomon leans in and says, don't waste it. Don't avoid it. Don't waste the gift of frustration in your life. Now, I don't want any of you talking to your spouses this week, and when they get mad at you, say, I just gave you a gift. It's good for your heart. We have to ask, well, what does Solomon mean here? Let me give you an example. There are, in this church right now, there seems to be multiplying these young, attractive, educated, upwardly mobile young couples coming to our church. And it's fun and it's exciting. You talk to them, you're like, you know, I just finished like mowing my lawn and taking out the trash. And then I call them up and say, hey, what are you doing? They're like, oh, I'm not going to be at church this weekend. Actually, we're going scuba diving in the Caribbean. I'm like, really? Or like, you call them up and be like, what are you doing this weekend? Oh, we're just running with the bulls in South Spain. We're like rock climbing. And I talk to them. Every time I talk to them, they're like going out to these hip restaurants and staying up late and going on these road trips and circling around the globe. And I'm like, good. I'm glad for you. I really am. I am not. I'm really glad. And these are godly couples, though. So if we start talking about your relationship as a couple, you start saying, so, you know, relationship is all about the mutual sacrifice and love for one another. And how does that come out in your life? And you're like, oh man, I am sacrificing for my spouse. Every time we go to a restaurant, I say, you get to pick the ultra cool restaurant tonight. And when I talk about love, they're like, they're all about love. Like, they just tell me about the myriad of gifts that they've dumped on each other. And now we're going to go to some romantic getaway. And I'm like, you know what? At that point, life is easy, and that's good. I'm not begrudging that. Enjoy that. Really. Because one of these days, you're going to have this great and terrible news. I'm pregnant. It begins with months of like vomiting and discomfort and walking like a duck. And nobody sleeps in the house. And that's just before the baby comes. And then after that, you will never again go to an ultra-hip restaurant. At least not in your youth. Now your idea of a great restaurant will be Chick-fil-A. And you're going to try and, you know, stay out late. But the idea of packing up, you're like, oh, let's go on one of our great trips. And then you start packing just for a day trip. And you realize, like, you have to buy a minivan just to carry all your junk, your baby junk. And it is frustrating, and it is hard. Dates become a thing of the past. Sacrifice used to mean, I'll let you choose the restaurant. Now sacrifice is defined as, I'll change the diarrhea diaper. Love used to mean a romantic getaway. Now love means, you know what? I'll do the 3 a.m. feeding. You can sleep. Solomon looks at this and he says, this is awful and this is hard and this is frustrating and it's beautiful. This is good for the heart because your love now is going to be different. Now your heart not only grew so that you can love as a parent, you can now love selflessly this little creature that can't do anything for you, but your love for one another is on a whole new depth. That now you know how to love each other when there's nothing fun and nothing enjoyable and nothing but pain, but you still love each other. Solomon says that there is a depth and quality of love that can only be known through frustration, through suffering, and through hardship. That there is a faith that only shines through sacrifice. That there is a love that can only be known in frustration, and there is a beauty to life that can only be seen in death. And don't miss it. Don't skip over it. Don't avoid the pain because you're missing out something that's good for your heart, good for your love. Verse 4. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of pleasure. I don't know if you, do you remember chapter 4 when Solomon just let it rip? Like he let everything in him, every doubt, every frustration, everything that twisted up his soul, he just vomited it up. It's when we came to that passage, I said, remember, in the medieval era, this book was actually banned from certain groups reading it. Like they were wondering, this should be rated R, and it was based on chapter 4. Do you remember the first thing he said, the first thing that causes his heart to doubt, the first thing that twists him up, he said, it's oppression. It's everywhere. Everyone's being oppressed, but it's not oppression itself. It's the fact that there are millions of people suffering and oppressed right now, and nobody seems to care. That right now, there are millions of people suffering and oppressed and in horrible hardship, people dying right now, and nobody seems to care. Like everybody cares more about their favorite TV show or their sports team or their next work project or what they're doing at their house or what they look like. Nobody cares. He's going to pick up that same theme right here. And he says this, if we ever want to heal, if we want to find any semblance of health in this life, any semblance of wholeness, then we need to open ourselves up to the pain that's around us. We need to enter the house of mourning. We need to spend less time drowning ourselves in pleasures, less time entertaining ourselves, less time purchasing new things, less time thinking about the next project and the next game and the next movie, and a little bit more time crying. That we need to let our hearts break for the things that break the heart of God. Listen, I'm no doctor. But I know that if it gets to the point where they stop treating the illness and they only treat the pain, they only numb the pain, then it's too late. It's bad. And you know, when people go to the house of pleasure, that's what they're doing, he says. Like when you see all this pain around you, you don't want to deal with it. So what do? I'm going to watch another movie. I'm going to buy another trinket. I'm going to start another project. I'm going to add on to my house. I'm going to avoid the pain. He says, if you numb yourself, you will never grow, you will never heal, you will never experience what life is all about. In his little book, The Problem of Pain, C.S. Lewis, who would later lose his wife to cancer, writes this fantastic quote. You may have heard it before. He says, we can ignore even pleasure, but pain insists upon being attended to. God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pains. It is God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world. That God uses pain and sorrow and frustration and mourning to teach us to hate sin, to hate brokenness, to hate the things that he hates. That he uses pain and suffering and mourning to teach us to long for him, to long for wholeness, to long for resurrection, to long for what we were created to be, which is in relationship with him. That God shouts to us in our pain, come to me, put your hope in me, learn to love like me, grow like me, hate what I hate, love what I love, long for what I long for. God shouts, remember these words, blessed are those who mourn because I will comfort them. Weep, mourn, and wail, you sinners, he says in James. Why? Because when you do that, I will forgive, I will heal, I will turn your mourning into dancing. I don't know what you think the Christian's life is like, but don't you hope that the Christian life will be like the life of Christ? And how does Isaiah describe the life of Christ? He said he was a man of sorrows. Like if you want to know one of the distinguishing features of his life, it was frustration and pain and suffering and mourning. Like if you just do a word study and you study the word clusters about anger, frustration, those types of things, with Jesus, you will find that he is mad at injustice. He is mad at people who abuse and oppress other people. That he is frustrated and torn up about unbelief. And when his close friend Lazarus dies,
Do you know the verse? The shortest verse in the Bible. He wept and wept and wept. It's the word for uncontrollable sobbing that keeps going on and on. That to become like Jesus Christ doesn't just mean love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness. But sometimes becoming like Christ means that we need to weep uncontrollably. That we need to sob for what's broken in our hearts and in our lives and in our church and in our world. That we need to sob because our kids are falling into sin. That we need to sob because our marriages aren't what they're supposed to be yet. We need to sob because our world is falling apart around us. It's better to heed the rebuke of a wise man, wise person, than to listen to the song of fools. There's two words in here that I don't like the way they're translated, wise and fools, because those words are used all over in the book of Ecclesiastes. But right here, these are two different words. These are two different words. They don't mean exactly the same thing that wise and fools would mean in the rest of the book. I'm not quite sure why they translated it that way, because have you ever had one of those conversations? I really like old people. You wouldn't know it from our church, but I really do. And, you know, you can learn so much and you can grow so much when you're around people who've had that experience. But one of the great things about old people is they get to a certain point where they just don't care anymore. Like, they will say anything. Like, who cares? I mean, it's the guy in front of you who, like, passes gas and then just says whatever comes to mind. It's great. Like, that type of freedom, to have that freedom. The only other person I know who has that kind of freedom is my 3-year-old son. He'll just do anything, too. He has no shame. Solomon is kind of at this point right now. He just said, let me directly translate this. He just said this. It's easy to surround yourself with stupid people. Like, there is nothing easier in life than to get a whole bunch of stupid people to hang out with you. And you know what? They're going to make you feel good about every decision you make. These stupid people, they're going to cheer on your bad choices. They're going to make you feel good about yourself. They're going to affirm you. So you're going to say, I'm thinking about leaving my wife. And they're going to say, oh, she never deserved you. They're going to find out that you're getting drunk, and they're going to say, you know what, you deserve to cut loose a little. They're going to find out you're cheating your employer, and they're going to say, that son of a gun deserved it anyways. They're going to find out that you can't forgive someone. You're an unforgiving person. And they're going to say, you know what, I wouldn't do it either if I were you. And they're going to affirm every bad decision you make. And Solomon says, those stupid words are going to be like music to your ears. It's the song of stupid people echoing. He says, but there's something better here. Someone who's clever. Someone who's smart. Someone who can see things for what they are. And he's going to come to you, and rather than tell you whatever you long to hear, he's going to say, you know what? I've been seeing something in your life, and I think it's really a problem. I think the problem is you. I think you're stepping out of bounds here. I think you're living in sin. Ouch. Like, there's going to be smart people who are going to come to you and say, this is sin. There's a problem in your life. And he says, if you want to know how to live life, you got to learn how to stop listening to the stupid people and heed the words of the smart person. And Solomon knows this firsthand. I don't know if you know the story of his father, David. David was king, just like Solomon. And he had lusted after another man's wife, committed adultery. She got pregnant. And when she got pregnant, he devised this plan to actually have her husband die. He plotted his death. It was murder. And then he took her as his own wife, took her into his own household. And here's the thing. For months, nobody seemed to say anything. Like, everyone in his household knew what was going on. Nobody said anything until you go to 2 Samuel chapter 12. And this guy, this wise man, this smart man named Nathan comes up and says, you know what, King David, I've got a story I want to tell you about. I really want your official opinion on this situation. He said, you know, there's this guy. This really wealthy man who has tons and tons of sheep and cattle and all these things. And he had a visitor coming to come meet him over to his house. And so this guy, though, he didn't want to get rid of any of his sheep or his cattle. So he went over to his next door neighbor who was dirt poor. And this guy only had one lamb. And this poor man, he loved this lamb. This lamb slept in their household. This lamb drank from his cup. He considered it like a daughter. And this rich man came, took that man's one lamb, slaughtered it, served it with a side of couscous. Now, David, what should we do about this? David, long before he was ever a king, he was a shepherd. And this was a guy who knew what it meant to be a poor shepherd who loved a lamb. So he hears this story, and he is just enraged. He says, that guy needs to die. He should be killed. He needs to pay back four times what he stole from that man. This is awful. And then Nathan leans in and says, David, you are the man. That Nathan, he's a smart guy. He knows that you can't directly confront the king, so he tells him a story about sheep and stealing sheep. And he allows David to see that he had every woman in the kingdom at his disposal. Instead, he stole this one poor man's wife. Nathan is rare. Men and women like Nathan are so rare. Men and women who will actually speak into your lives and tell you the truth. But you know what's even more rare? David. A person who will hear the truth, be confronted with their sin, and what does he do? He's crushed. He repents. And then he becomes more famous for his repentance than for his sins. Here's the deal. None of us come close to being a sinner like David. David is a man after God's own heart, but it has nothing to do with sinless perfection. This guy is awesome at sinning. He could be any of us. What makes David so rare? Psalm 51. I know my transgressions and my sin is always before me. You were right in your verdict and justified when you judged me. Surely I was sinful at birth, sinful from the time my mother conceived me. Cleanse me, wash me. Let me hear joy and gladness again. Hide your face from my sins. Create in me a pure heart. He has a broken and contrite spirit. And that is rare. Solomon says, if you want to see what life is all about, it's not about sinless perfection. It's about when someone points your sin out to you, that you repent like David. At this point, Solomon seems to be tired. He's coming to the end of his breath. I'm tired. Before we leave today, though, he wants to leave us with one last image. One horrific image that he wants seared into our minds. It's the image of a person burning alive. Verse 6. Like the crackling of thorns under the pot, so is the laughter of fools. It says that fools, when their life is burning down around them, they laugh. So how are you doing? How are things going? Aha! Awesome. It's great. So how's your marriage? Couldn't be better. How's work? Sweet. How's your relationship with God? It's fine, you know? Things are good. And they pretend like everything's okay while their life is burning down around them. And he says, that's a fool. You're a fool if you think you can escape, if you think you can put the fire out on your own, if you think pretending is going to help anything. A wise person, when their lives are burning down, they don't laugh. They don't pretend like everything's okay. They say, oh my God, I'm on fire. Wise people, when their marriage starts to smoke and starts to burn, they say, I think we have a problem here. We need to get fixed. We need to find help. When their faith starts to be strained, when they start to struggle, they come to someone and say, I need help. I think there's a problem here. When they start bad habits, they catch it early and they say, oh, I've got a problem here. I need help. They don't pretend like everything's okay. Do you have any idea of how many marriages could be saved if early on they had said, I think we have a problem here. Something's not right. There's smoke. There's fire. There's a problem. We need to put this out. You know when I hear about it? When their whole house is burnt down and everything's over and everyone's charred and all they need now is an ER. That's when I hear about it. Do you know how many addictions could have been avoided if someone early on said, this is a sin, I'm struggling with it, I don't know what to do? Do you know how many friendships and how many families and how many churches could have been saved if people didn't try and pretend like everything's okay? No one's going to get healed. Your world's going to burn down around you. And what does Solomon say? His famous last line, this too is meaningless, roughly translated, are you kidding me? Really, that's your plan. That's your plan. Like, you're burning with these secret sins. Like, your marriage is falling apart, and your plan is to pretend like everything's okay. That's your plan. Now, a wise person is going to find help. And with that, he's done. That's it. You've just sat there, your head spinning. This guy who has years of life experience, this guy who's reportedly one of the wisest men in the world, this guy who has no shame, who calls people what they are, stupid and smart, this guy who's ready to just expose the sin in your life, who's ready to lead you to the house of mourning, this guy who's ready to send you through pain, if he thinks it'll be good for your heart and good for you in the long run, he just leaves. Now you've heard the words of wisdom. And the question is, what are you going to do with it?